When you're experiencing spiritual pain, often we ask the question, is God punishing me? My guest today is Dr. Alicia Britt Shalee, and we're talking about suffering and how we can understand where God is and what he is doing when the darkness doesn't lift. That's today on The Truth and Our Trauma. Ever sit down to pray and end up thinking about what you need to buy at the store instead? No judgment. I've totally been there. And that's why I decided to create the Ignite Strategic Prayer Planner and Journal. Know what to pray, track your impact, and learn to hear God's voice for yourself. Ignite is more than just a journal. It's a journey. And it's available now on Amazon and at the link in the show notes. At a time in the not-so-distant past, I had experienced years of suffering and spiritual pain. It's in these periods of suffering where we question what we know about God, we question our relationship with him, and we have to really come to terms with the fact that we don't really understand always what he's doing. But when the suffering gets long for us, we can often wonder if God is punishing us, if he's removing his love from us, or if we have just done something so irreparably wrong. My guest today is Dr. Alicia Britt Shalee, and she's here to talk about this experience of disillusionment often that we're going through when we experience spiritual pain, but it causes us then to have lots of questions about all sorts of different aspects of our faith. She talks about the fact that these darker periods of our faith are not a failure of our faith, but rather are integral to the experience of being able to grow in our ability to trust God. Dr. Alicia, it's so wonderful to get to sit with you today. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Michelle, for the opportunity. It's an honor to be with you and your listeners.
Now, we're going to be talking a little bit about something that many of the listeners may be experiencing right now, but maybe don't necessarily have words for it when it comes to a season of suffering and this experience of disillusionment that we're going through. A lot of times we know that there's something that's wrong. We know we're questioning God. We know that there's a lot of things that we believed that suddenly we may not necessarily know that we believe anymore. And disillusionment, though, is really what you mentioned in The Night is Normal is something this is what we're experiencing. This is what we can call this experience. Would you talk about how, while this is disorienting and it may be very uncomfortable, that this is actually a good thing when it comes to the development of our faith and really what is going on when we're experiencing this?
Yes. You know, the whole entire reason I wrote the book, Michelle, was because of my deep, deep concern for how easy it is to mistake spiritual pain for spiritual failure when we don't have a framework within which to process those seasons where we are doubting, grieving, questioning, where we feel lost in the dark. It's easy for us to mistake the pain for some kind of failure or even some kind of exit from our faith. When historically, both throughout the scriptures and in the history of those who have followed God, these darker seasons, these night seasons, are actually invitations to deepen our love for God. They are doorways through which our relationship with God has the opportunity to grow, not through a nice concise ability to connect the dots, but through the choice to trust God. And trust is really what leads us more deeply into love. We always hope it's answers, but it is trust. So these spaces, they are not only familiar, they're mentors. One of the things that captivated me when I began to do the study that spilled over into this book was the realization that the night was one of the original residents of the Garden of Eden. The night wasn't something that got tacked on after the fall, after the curse, after our failure. The night was actually one of the original residents. Scripture speaks of how God created the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. which meant there would always be a nightlight on in every season. And it also meant that from the very, very beginning, walking with God required not only day faith, but night faith. And I think that the image is accurate. In the daytime, we see clearly. We walk confidently. We feel like we know fully. And then the lights go out. In the night, spiritually, we seem to know less. We seem to feel less. We seem to stumble as opposed to be certain. But these seasons, in the daylight, faith glitters. It's true. But in the night, faith grows depth. And it's that depth that comes through spiritual pain that seasons faith. And you can tell it, you can taste it. When you walk alongside of somebody whose faith has been seasoned by the night, the compassion, there is an extra depth of, could we just call it maybe humility, that inspires more compassion for others who are also walking through the night. We discard the pat answers because they didn't help us and they're not going to help others.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you that there is this, you use the word seasoning, but I think deepening even captures so much of that feeling. Depth of faith that you can absolutely feel off of someone or feel even out of yourself when this is the experience that you've had. And I so appreciate the understanding, though, of day faith and night faith, because I think a lot of times what happens in Christian culture, for example, or in our churches, is we really only focus on day faith. We only focus on what it looks like when everything is sailing along and you're able to take that faith and, you know, apply it in all these really wonderful ways and go out there and move and shake and change the world. Mm-hmm. And when you're in the night, it doesn't look anything like that. It doesn't feel anything like that.
No, it doesn't. And I'm going to press it even further. I would say that not only is that our emphasis, I think that there is an error in our generation of followers of Jesus, that day faith is a reward for obedience. We confuse the abundance for obedience. And so we think if we keep just doing the right things, thinking the right things, feeling the right things, that we'll be able to stay in the day, even though all around us, God's images that he teaches us, that the night is necessary. So we keep trying to string experiences together to stay in the day and to resist the night. And in doing so, we're resisting a depth that we desperately need, that the world desperately needs. If we're going to have something to say to a wounded, broken world, it's going to have to come from people who have made peace with also being wounded and broken themselves.
Well, and I think those mindsets of day faith, actually, those, or perhaps, I shouldn't even say of day faith, but perhaps of the still growing, maybe less mature faith, those mindsets are often where we find ourselves then in this experience of disillusionment as we go into the night thinking, but wait, I had this formula or I did everything right. Yes. Or, but, you know, we just really wrestle with these mindsets in the dark because we don't understand how we got there. And I think we want to get out as quickly as possible. It does not sure. feel good, right?
Yes, absolutely. Well, it happens. It sneaks up on us. It sneaks up on us. We spiritualize optimism and we call it faith.
Hmm.
And so when we come upon like Matthew 26 and Jesus describes his soul as troubled and overwhelmed and sorrowful, we just keep reading. But Jesus was sinless and he was troubled and he was holy and he was sorrowful. He was perfectly obedient and he was overwhelmed. And if we say we want to be like him, then we are going to have to make room for Garden of Gethsemane Christianity in our lives.
I think that is something of these conversations that is so important, is to normalize that this is the life of faith. It really is that in becoming more like Christ and in knowing Christ, like that's really where the knowing of Christ is in these seasons, is where everything is stripped away and it is so bare bones. And we are so met in that, but we are also, though, very much isolated. And I think that is one of the deepest parts of this, is the aloneness that for so long, especially as we resist it, seems to be utterly excruciating. And yet it's in the depth of what feels to be a season of absolute aloneness where we become the most known, the most met, the mm-hmm. most, like we feel ourselves as the most treasured and the most beloved. But as you said, it can sneak up on us. And I was even telling a friend today, I said, I don't know how many years I was into a wilderness season before I realized, like, oh, that's where I am right now. There was no like road marker of, you know, now entering the wilderness. I didn't recognize that. And I think the other thing though, too, is sometimes these seasons don't feel like a season. They feel like this is life. This is the way it has mm-hmm. been. And maybe it's always going to be this way. Mm-hmm.
Yes. There are times when the night becomes more of a companion than a stopping point. I think of a friend who, after 2.5 years of marriage, had a horrible car accident, and she was a paraplegic for decades, still is today. Well, that means the night has become a companion. Right? We're special needs family, Michelle. And so there are certain ways in which the night becomes a companion as you grieve what your children are experiencing, what your children will experience. The other day, I just happened upon a conversation between someone who was talking about the ache they had regarding taking care of aging parents who were entering dementia. And another person that was there far before I walked into the conversation kept encouraging them to see the silver lining. You know, your parents, at least they're alive, and think of these sweet memories you have, and, you know, be sure to take advantage of this. And it was very positive. And when the other person left, I turned to my friend and I said, I just want to encourage you that grieving is a discipline. And yes, there are many positives and there are many treasures, but grieving is a discipline. Grieving has now become your companion. And grieving, what it does is it helps us integrate the pain instead of isolate the pain. And that's where the depth comes. I think of those who've entered the night suddenly, a doctor's diagnosis, a spouse that turns to them and says, I know I said I do at one point, but now I don't. A business that collapsed, a betrayal that just absolutely took their breath away. There are times where we enter the night suddenly. There are also times when we enter the night slowly, where the shadows gather and things that we were so certain of, now we're frighteningly uncertain of. We enter the night in a lot of different ways, but grieving becomes a companion through it all. There is a loss. The thing about spiritual disillusionment, though, is that the loss means that there's also a gain. And this is how disillusionment is different from despair. The actual word disillusionment means the negation of false ideas and ideals. It's the loss of illusions. That's what's happening in the night. We're losing some illusions about God. We're losing some illusions about what it was like to follow God. We're losing some illusions about those people of God. But disillusionment is not all loss. Implicit in the definition is the opportunity for gain. To lose an illusion is to gain a reality. And that's what happens. And so what that framework does is it transforms the night. It reframes the night more accurately. It takes it away from the realm of failure, and it places it squarely in the realm of growth. So are you in a night? Are our listeners in a night? This is not failure. It means that we're growing. It means that we are growing, that our faith is expanding, our faith is maturing, and without question, our love is being purified.
Okay, this one is for all my overthinkers out there. I used to be absolutely debilitated by intrusive thoughts. Everything from constant worry to just dread of the future, I couldn't make it stop. If you're there right now, I have developed a free downloadable guide to help you get your mind back. It's called Overthinking: Get Out of Your Head and On with Your Life. And you can download it for free right now at uncommonvalor.co. I really appreciate the emphasis you just made there on the fact that there is gain too.
Yes.
And that really some of what is being lost was never real to start with.
Yes.
And I've absolutely found that in my own life. If I think about what was life like before I got divorced versus where I am now, there is such an ability to, for some of us, to architect and control our lives in such a way that we have the ability, as you said before, to call it the favor of God, mm-hmm. call it faith, you know, make it that this abundance again is an outcome of my obedience that I have. Mm-hmm. I'm ultimately the master of my own domain. And yet that's an illusion. That is not, that's not real. And so while there is a grieving of that, the what felt like the good parts of that experience, there is also, though, a gain in recognizing, wow, that's really stressful to feel like I'm in control of my own life. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of dependency, as hard as it is, I want to say that to somebody who's listening, as hard as it is yes. to work into a dependency and a trust of a God that you don't fully understand, mm-hmm. that there is this returning, though, to God's original design in it, that there yes. is a returning to Eden as much as we can, you know, on this side of eternity, of the childlike dependency that God designed us for mm-hmm. and the freedom that is implicit in that design to us. There yes. are going to be complications along the way for sure. And it is not yeah. easy to integrate those two things because as we become more aware of the reality, we become more aware of the fullness of being alive in all of its pain and all of its glory. It's everything. And yes. while there's a period of time where I think that that's intolerable to some extent and can absolutely be disheartening, it's beautiful to have a light post, you know, along the way, such as yourself, who's able to say, you're gaining something. You yes. are gaining something. It feels like loss after loss after loss. You're gaining something.
Yes. Yes. And part of what we gain is sobriety. Mm. Reality is a friend of intimacy with God, and denial is an enemy of it. And so the more honest, the more real we can be about life, including the parts that we have no idea what's going on, including the truth that, wow, I'm finite and God is infinite, and in between is mystery. And that mystery is not code for I don't know. That mystery is not code for I don't give a rip. That mystery is also not code for I'm making excuses for God. That mystery is invitation. I think of Job's miserable comforters. We love the book of Job. Job's pain was initiated by a conversation in a realm that was beyond his sight. And a lot of our pain is too. We live in a fallen world. We live in a world where there is spiritual darkness, not just night. And a lot of the things that we're walking through were initiated in realms beyond our view, just like Job. But his quote unquote comforters come alongside. And initially they acted like true friends. They sat in silence with him while he grieved. But then they started offering their advice. They started offering their platitudes. And basically what they were saying is that if you do right, your life will be right. And since your life isn't right, what did you do wrong? And these are the accusations not only that come from others, but I think even more painfully come from within our own souls. What did I do wrong? How did I get here? What turn did I make? What secret sin am I unaware of? We blame ourselves. And sometimes, certainly, there are things we could have all done differently. We are human. Every single one of us is in the midst of a growth process. But a lot of the pain in this world is simply the fallout of the fall. And I think of how they spoke to Job. And if you'd allow me to paraphrase, I think what they were trying to tell them is summer is a reward and winter is a punishment. Job, you're in winter. So what are you being punished for? And I love Job's tenacity. I love how he refused to fabricate something to make it more sensical. He said, no, I want to bring my case before God. I am not perfect, but I want to bring my case before God. And I think that it was that longing to be honest, fiercely honest, almost at times disrespectfully honest to God, that keeps the wound, it keeps the pain uninfected. And that's the real journey in the night. Wail, weep, cry, yell, accuse, direct your questions, direct your doubt to God. And that fierce honesty, that is what keeps the woundedness uninfected. That's where the work is. It's not in trying to figure out where the exit sign is, though, like everybody else, I'm like, dear God, the sooner the better, please. I don't want to hang out here any longer than I have to. But the real work is in the honesty to God. That's where the growth is. That's where trust grows. That's where we realize that we are absolutely loved.
And the trusting, even in that process, as you mentioned, strengthens as we continue to press forward in with those questions, as you said, but not turning away from the challenge, not removing ourselves from the challenge, but pushing in, as you said, even to the point where Job is crossing the line, you know, where he is saying, well, I'm going to make my case, you know?
Yeah, no, Job has attitude. And I love it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Because I think, though, it is reflective of when we are really trying to seek what we believe, though, are the answers. We believe at some point, if I can get an answer to this, then I'm going to feel better. Mm-hmm. If I can reason through this, then I'm going to feel better. And even in, though, the tenacity of Job to seek the answers, that the Lord responds to him with something that is just even purely above Job's understanding. He's just saying to him, Job, I'm God. Mm-hmm. Job, you haven't seen the whole thing. You don't know how the earth is all constructed. You don't know even the warfare that is behind all this. You don't know. And to the extent where Job is able to say, oh my goodness, you're right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I had just heard of you before. Now I see you. Now I know. Yes. But even in that, those places where the disillusionment falls off and we realize even some of those spaces where we can grow in our trust and grow in our understanding of how God is the way that I frame that, but how kind the Lord was in moving Job through that process to say, Job, you came to me though. And actually now I'm going to have you pray for those knuckleheads who were, trying to quote unquote comfort you. Like you friends, you need Job to pray for you, you know?
Yes.
But he's restoring him in a favored position and saying, but you came to me. You brought it to me. And I actually want you now to be in this intercessory space because you know me, because you and I have a connection that we didn't have before because you came forward. And yes. But that's what precedes even all of the other restoration that happened in Job's life. And it didn't mm-hmm. take away any of the suffering that he experienced. Mm-hmm. But the trusting, though, of on Job's part to even come with the questions. And I think that's the thing when we think about trusting God, what does that mean? How do I even do mm-hmm. that? It doesn't mm-hmm. always start with being able to say, well, he's God and I'm not. Like, that's okay. Yeah. You know, it starts with saying, I don't get it. Mm-hmm. And what an yes. act of trust that is, though, to say, and I don't think you're going to discard me or get rid yes. of me because I say, I don't get you.
Yes, absolutely. My dad made an incredible investment in me when I was little, and actually all my days until he passed away. My dad would sit me down, Michelle, and he would say, what's the daughter thinking? What kind of questions do you have? What are you wondering about? What are you worrying about? And I would pour out my heart to my dad. You know, when I was little, it was some weird dream I had. As I got older and my thinking became a little more complex, you know, I shared my angst about global injustice and things that just weren't fair. And we discussed everything from politics to economics to religion. We just discussed it all. And when I look back on those many years, you know, staying up way, way, way into the wee hours past Johnny Carson's monologue and dipping Oreos in milk and talking and talking and talking. Michelle, I don't remember one single solution that we came to. I don't even remember a single answer because that wasn't the point. The point was that honesty revealed safety, and safety infused my heart with trust, and trust opened the door to love. And there's the pattern in the night. It is honesty that gives us the revelation of safety. I'm still received. I'm still loved. His eyes are still, he's still just as near. My greatest doubt didn't thin him. How glorious. That opens the way I can trust someone who accepts me so fully, so honestly. And trust opens the way to love. There's the invitation in our nights. And I think that's why, not just once, but twice, we're invited into the fellowship of Jesus' sufferings. And Jesus suffered because of the fallout of the fall. Well, we are too. Every single one of us, the fallout of the fall, it touches us, it reaches us. And there is fellowship there. But fellowship cannot be created when we isolate our pain and isolate ourselves from the only God who could possibly understand what we're truly experiencing.
I love the way that you just stair-step that through as far as how those layers of trust lead us, you know, through this experience, but that safety being so key to that. And that's what mm-hmm. we gain in vulnerability with the Lord, that there is zero risk for us to bring our full selves to the Lord.
Yes.
He will fully accept us every time. And yes. for many of us, there is an experience of not being safe somewhere along the line, and probably multiple places along the line, and often very young, that create this sense in us that feels lifelong, feels like it will mm-hmm. never stop of feeling unsafe. And even in my own processing and angst as healing continues, this issue of safety keeps coming back. Mm-hmm. And the Lord, though, it's only in the Lord where things like suffering and trauma could actually be a conduit for receiving totally perfect love. Only mm-hmm. in God can something mm-hmm. so heinous be a gateway for us to be able to walk through and experience his absolute perfect love and care for us. And that yes. he's even teaching me through the continuing, you know, to walk through the healing journey, that then not to fear the angst, not to fear the anxiety, even not mm-hmm. to fear any of the emotional experiences that I don't want to feel, because I can then have the expectation that I'm going to be met, and that this need for safety gets satiated a little more every time I do it. And that's really, it's not healing. Like we just slap a Band-Aid on it and then, you know, it's going to be fine. He is again and again asking us to revisit these things that we don't want to, but as we continue to trust him with that process, that there's something a little more and a little more and a little more that gets filled in every time.
Yes.
And that little by little is excruciatingly slow, but he's so thorough in that process.
Yes. Yes. And every moment of that process is equally sacred. The beginning is just as sacred as the end and every single step along the way. Every step we make in honesty towards God is equally sacred. One of the most beautiful things, I think, for me is how the process, staying in the process, is the victory. We keep thinking victory's on the other side. I disagree. There is a victory, no question, on the other side. But I say staying in the process is victorious. I think that Mary and Martha were victorious before their brother's resurrection because they looked Jesus in the eye and said, if you'd have been here, he wouldn't have died. And they grieved. Victory. They looked him in the eye. They told him what he thought. They told him what they thought. You could have made a difference, and I don't understand why you didn't. But here I am to follow you. That's victorious. And I think that's the kind of victory, honestly, that scares the death out of the kingdom of darkness. And there was an amazing quote in Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, which is a conversation between an older demon mentoring a younger demon. And I'm not going to quote this perfectly, but the older demon says to the younger demon, "Do not be deceived, Wormwood. Our cause is never in more danger than when a Christian, no longer seeing but still believing, looks round upon a universe from which every trace of God seems to have vanished, asked, 'Why have I been forsaken?' and yet still obeys." The kingdom of darkness is never in more danger than when we look around in the night and we say, "God, it's so dark, I can't even see my hand in front of my face. But I still choose to follow you." There's victory.
That is so life-giving, what you just said. I know so often process feels like pointless. Like it just feels pointless, or it feels just like torment for torment's sake. And to know, though, that staying just even in process,
yes,
you can see that as victorious. You are so right. There's this absolute holy defiance of the darkness in being able to say, "I'm not gone yet. Mm-hmm. I'm not stopping." And how, as you paralleled that with Mary and Martha, that the Lord even, I believe, grieves the process. That Jesus didn't walk in there and say, "Well, don't worry about it. I'm going to raise him. It's good. Like I told you, I'm the resurrection." You know, before he raises Lazarus, he weeps because he sees what this process of suffering and death and all of that does to us. And yet it is the very process by which we experience victory over the darkness, over the things that are trying to take us down.
Yes. Yes. Which is why his call is so true. What did he say? He just said, "Follow me." It was all about the company we keep. It wasn't about the scenery. There were no promises about the circumstances. There was this deep, deep, deep promise of relationship and leadership. That's what follow me is all about. So we follow him through the day, skipping, through the night, weeping. Both are as much obedience as each other.
Dr. Alicia, there are probably 4 or 5 times during this conversation that I have just had like jaw-dropping wow moments because of the insight that you have shared. And I'm just so appreciative of the way that you're able to, with so much compassion, articulate what this experience is like so that there is light in that darkness. And an ability to just understand that the heart of our Lord in these things for us is so good. that he's so close and so near. For listeners who want to know more about your work and how they can follow along with you, can you tell them more about how they can get in touch?
Oh, happy to. Instagram is probably the best place. I'm very responsive to messages if people want to reach out. Obviously, I can't counsel through Instagram, but I love to interact with people. The newest book, as you've mentioned, is called The Night is Normal, A Guide Through Spiritual Pain. It has a workbook, 8 teaching videos, and it is the overflow, Michelle, of 30 years of my life. This is my life work, and I'm so grateful that God opened up a door for me to be able to wrap words around it and to offer it.
And it's been a tremendous blessing to me, absolutely, and I'll include links in the show notes, but thank you again for sitting down with me.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it. Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks for being with me for this episode today. I hope you'll come back again. And in the meantime, you can follow me over on social media and find out about our resources and services over at uncommonvalor.co.